When you really look at hockey, it's just 50 minutes of pure, beautiful chaos.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, if you strip away the jerseys and just watch the movement, it's a game of continuous flow. You've got players skating at 30 miles an hour, navigating these like completely unpredictable bounces of vulcanized rubber off curved boards.
Right, the variables are just, they're near infinite.
Exactly. It's the most fluid sport on earth.
Yeah.
But then, roughly 56 times a game, the whistle blows and the chaos just stops.
Dead in its tracks.
Yeah. The players lock into this exact highly regulated grid, and for 3 seconds, this incredibly fluid sport becomes a rigid, binary, closed skill event.
The face-off era.
Face-off, right? Welcome to the deep dive, everyone. Our mission today is to completely transform your mental model of this specific event.
Because it really is the ultimate paradox of the sport, you know?
It really is. And we're pulling from this incredible stack of sources today, primarily centered around face-offs, learning to play the game. We're going to deconstruct this down to a molecular level.
Yeah, we spend so much time analyzing systems and like flow in transition games, but at its core, the face-off is hockey's equivalent to a tennis serve or a chess
Oh,
opening.
I love that comparison. A
Yeah.
chess opening.
Right. It's an entirely different physics problem than the rest of the game. You have a fixed starting position, a fixed distance, a highly specific physical cue, and an absolutely binary outcome.
You either win possession or you lose it.
Exactly. And the mechanics of how that win or loss happens, well, they dictate the geometry of the entire shift that follows.
So if you're with us today, you already know the rink. We aren't going to talk about basic geography or, what a hash mark is.
Yeah, we can skip the basics.
We are here to talk about the hidden mind games, the spatial geometry, the rulebook variations that even professional broadcasters get wrong, and the five-player tactical alignments that turn a simple puck drop into a meticulously choreographed set play.
Because if you really want to understand the modern game, I mean, you have to look past the center, hunched over the dot.
Right. I always look at the face-off like a bank heist.
A bank heist. Okay, I like where this is going.
Think about it. Everyone in the arena, all 20,000 fans, are staring at the guy picking the lock, the center.
Right, the lock picker.
But the actual success of the heist doesn't just rely on the lock picker. It relies on the four other people in the crew executing their exact rehearsed jobs the very millisecond the vault opens.
Yeah, if the getaway driver twitches a fraction of a second too early.
The lock picker goes to jail.
Exactly. And the rules surrounding this are just incredibly punitive.
But before we get into the mechanics of the lock, we have to address why we are getting into this specific vault in the first place.
Right, the motivation.
Because if you spend enough time around rinks, you hear the same coaching cliche repeated ad nauseum, which is face-offs win games.
Oh, man, yeah. It is arguably the most pervasive myth in hockey analytics. And honestly, we need to dismantle it systematically right now.
Let's do it.
Because if you build your tactical understanding of the game on the premise that raw faceoff percentages dictate the standings, you are, well, you're building on sand.
So what does the actual data say?
Let's look at it. When you aggregate 11 NHL seasons, which, by the way, gives us a massive sample size of 344 team seasons, the correlation between a team overall face-off win percentage and the share of standings points they accumulate is about 0.25.
Wow. Let's translate that R value for a second for the listeners.
Yeah.
An R value of 0.25 means that a team's face-off percentage explains only about 6% of the variance in their overall points.
Right, exactly.
So if you are a 100-point team, your face-off prowess is responsible for maybe 6 of those points over an entire 82-game season.
Right. It is statistically negligible at the macro level. It is
Yeah.
so unstable as a predictive metric that in the 2016 to 17 season, the relationship actually inverted. It went slightly negative.
Wait, really? A negative correlation?
Yeah. And if we look at the most recent 2025-26 data, the correlation was essentially zero.
That's wild.
Furthermore, the actual mathematical spread between the absolute best face-off team in the league and the absolute worst is just incredibly compressed.
Give us the numbers on that.
So in 2025-26, the premier face-off team sat at 54.5%. The worst was at 45.9%.
Okay, so we are talking about a total range of less than 9 percentage points separating the elite from the bottom feeders.
Exactly, less than 9%.
Okay, I want to push back on this though.
Sure, go ahead.
Because if we accept that team level statistics are essentially just statistical noise, and that overall percentage doesn't move the needle on a team's macro success, Well, it creates a massive contradiction.
How so?
Why do general managers consistently pay face-off specialists millions of dollars? Like, why do coaches obsess over these matchups if the data says it doesn't matter?
Because the team-level data is a blended average, and blended averages obscure extreme individual variance.
Okay, explain that.
When you look at team stats, you're throwing everything into a blender, right? You've got the elite top-line centers, the rookies, the backup centers taking defensive draws, and even the wingers who get forced to take emergency draws because someone got tossed out of the circuit.
Right, the emergency guys.
Yeah, so when you aggregate all of that, it heavily regresses toward 50%. But the secret emerges when you separate the team data from the individual skater data.
So what happens when you isolate the individual centers?
The spread just explodes. Let's look at the 109 NHL centers who took a statistically significant sample, so at least 500 draws, in the 2025-26 season.
Right.
The top center in the league won 62.1% of his draws. The worst center in that same cohort won 39.7%.
Oh, wow. That is a 22-point spread.
Right. And a 22-point spread in a highly repetitive, closed-skill physical action, that is the statistical proof that this is not merely luck or coin flipping.
It's a distinct skill.
Exactly. It is a highly specialized, learnable skill. There is a massive, quantifiable talent gap between the best and the worst lockpickers, to use your analogy, in the league.
So we have this paradox, right? The individual skill gap is massive, but the aggregate team success doesn't correlate to winning the game. The bridge between those two facts has to be the context of the draw. It's not about how many you win, it's about which ones you win.
This is the core mental model that modern analytics has brought to coaching. You have to stop chasing overall face-off percentages. It's just a vanity metric.
Vanity metric, yeah.
Like, if you win a neutral zone draw in the second period of a tied game, the statistical value of that win decays almost instantly.
Because of the decaying value of possession.
Precisely. Research mapping puck possession shows that regardless of who wins a neutral or offensive zone faceoff, the shot volume and expected goals between the two teams even out to be perfectly identical about 10 seconds after the puck drops.
So winning the draw just buys you a 10-second head start. It doesn't fundamentally tilt the ice for the whole shift.
Exactly. So what do the smart teams do? They chase the leverage.
Okay, so out of the 56 or so draws a game, how many are we talking about?
Well, 40 of them are essentially statistical noise.
Yeah.
But there are maybe 10 to 15 draws a game where the outcome instantly and violently alters the game state.
You're talking about like a defensive zone draw on a penalty kill or a late game draw protecting a one goal lead.
Exactly. Think about the spatial geometry and the risk profile of a defensive zone penalty kill draw.
Right.
If your center loses that draw cleanly to the opponent's point, you have instantly handed possession to a set opponent who is running a rehearsed, choreographed power play system in the most dangerous ice on the rink.
Well, your penalty killers are starting from a stationary position.
Yes, facing their own net. That is an immediate high danger scoring threat generated in under 2 seconds. That is where the 62% face-off specialist earns their paycheck.
So for everyone listening, what should we remember here? What is the main takeaway about face-off statistics so far?
The team aggregates are a distraction. The signal and the noise is the individual skill level applied to high leverage situations.
Right. You don't pay a guy to win a draw at center ice in October. You pay him to win a defensive zone draw in a one goal game in May.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. Which means we need to understand exactly how teams arrive at those high leverage situations.
Mm-hmm.
It's not random. The rule book dictates a highly specific geography of cause and effect.
Okay, let's map this out. We know there are 9 dots on the ice. 4 in the neutral zone, 4 in the end zones, 1 at center ice.
Right.
And we know the end zone dots have the 15-foot circles with the hash marks and the L-shaped restraining lines. But what actually dictates which of those 9 dots the linesperson is going to point to?
Well,
because an elite player isn't waiting for the official to point. Right. They're reading the play and skating to the dot before the whistle even stops echoing.
Exactly. The rules of stoppage are deeply tactical, especially when it comes to offsides and goalie covers. Let's look at offsides first, because the modern rulebook has fundamentally changed how teams evaluate the risk of zone entries.
How so?
Well, if your team attempts to carry the puck over the blue line and gets called offside, the resulting face-off goes to the neutral zone dot just outside that blue line.
So you lose maybe 5 or 10 feet of territorial advantage. It's a minor penalty in terms of geography.
Right. But what if a defenseman tries to hit a forward with a massive stretch pass from their own defensive zone, and the forward catches it offside at the far blue line?
Oh, under current rules, The faceoff doesn't stay near the offensive blue line. It goes all the way back to the zone where the pass originated.
Exactly. It goes back to your own defensive zone dot.
Which mathematically shifts the entire risk-reward profile of transition hockey. Mm. Carrying the puck is inherently safer from a territorial standpoint.
Yes. It forces coaches to demand controlled entries rather than hopeful stretch passes.
Because if you carry it and mess up the timing, you take a neutral zone draw.
Mm-hmm.
If you attempt a stretch pass and mess up the timing, you are gifting the opposing team a high-leverage offensive zone draw right in front of your goaltender.
Precisely. Now, consider when a goalie freezes the puck. If a goaltender makes a save and covers the puck to stop play, under NHL and IIHF rules, the ensuing faceoff goes to the end zone dot on the side where the stoppage occurred.
Meaning the side of the net where the goalie actually pinned the puck to the ice.
Correct. And elite goaltenders are acutely aware of this. This isn't just about stopping the puck. It is about manipulating the restart.
Wait, goalies are thinking about faceoffs while making a save.
Oh, absolutely. If a goalie knows that their first line center is a right-handed shot who absolutely dominates on the right side faceoff dot, that goalie will make a conscious physical effort to steer rebounds to the right side or slide to the right side to cover a loose puck.
Just to force the officials to drop the puck on their center's strong side.
Exactly. It is highly orchestrated.
That is an incredible layer of the game within the game. The goalie actively selecting the faceoff location based on the biomechanical preferences of their center.
And once that location is set, we immediately enter the psychological warfare of the line change, which is governed by the last change procedure.
Right. The moment the whistle blows, the referee starts a very specific countdown. The visiting team gets a maximum of 5 seconds to substitute their players.
The referee stands with their arm raised. During those 5 seconds, the visiting coach has to commit. They have to put their cards on the table.
And when the 5 seconds are up,
the referee drops their arm. That physical gesture closes the window for the visitors. They are now locked in. At that exact moment, the home team's window opens and they are granted up to 8 seconds to make their changes.
It's a game of poker where the home team always gets to act last. They get to see the visiting team's hand before they bet.
Yes.
So if I'm the home coach and I see the visiting coach send out their absolute best top six scoring line, I can take those 8 seconds to deploy a dedicated shutdown checking line anchored by a center who wins 60% of their defensive zone draws.
Which perfectly explains why away centers historically face statistically tougher matchups. The home coach is actively hunting the visiting centers, weaponizing that 8-second window to create mismatches.
Oh.
And once that 8-second window closes, the lines person blows their whistle, and both teams have exactly 5 seconds to physically line up at the dot.
And if you dawdle, it's a delay of game penalty.
Usually, yes. But there is a massive exception to this setup clock.
Oh, right. What's the exception?
In the NHL and IIHF, that strict 5-second setup clock is completely ignored during the last 2 minutes of regulation and throughout overtime.
Because the stakes are too high.
Exactly. The governing bodies recognize they don't want to rush the players in those moments. They want both teams perfectly legally set before a potentially game-deciding puck drop.
Unless you're playing USA Hockey.
Right. USA Hockey rules do not grant that late-game relaxation. The pacing is relentless. Even with 10 seconds left in a tied championship game, the linesperson is mandated to enforce that 5-second setup clock.
So why is this important? How does this connect to our mental model for the listeners?
Well, knowing where the puck is going before the whistle finishes allows you to skate there early. And understanding last change explains why away centers face such tough matchups. It's all about anticipating the leverage.
All right, so we've navigated the geography, the goalie has manipulated the location, the coaches have played their poker hands with the last change, and we are finally standing at the dot.
The lines person has the puck in their hand.
This brings us to the actual physical terrain of the draw,
mm-hmm.
and a rule that completely dictates the biomechanics of the interaction. Who has to put their stick on the ice first?
Yes. And if you poll casual hockey fans or even some hardcore fans and ask them who has to put their stick down first, the vast majority will tell you it is the visiting team.
I mean, I've heard broadcasters say it on air.
I have too. And they are fundamentally wrong in almost every critical situation on the ice.
Wait, really?
Under NHL and IIHF rules, the visiting player is only forced to place their stick down first at the one single dot at center ice.
Which, as we've established, is the lowest leverage dot on the rink.
Mm-hmm.
What about the other 8 dots?
At the 4 end zone spots and the 4 neutral zone spots, the NHL and IIHF rulebook is absolute. The defending player must place their stick on the ice first, followed immediately by the attacking player.
Okay, I want to break down exactly why this matters. Because to the untrained eye, the order in which two players touch a piece of composite carbon fiber to the ice seems like arbitrary bureaucracy.
It does seem that way, but it's really not.
It is actually the most significant tactical advantage you can grant a player, right?
It is entirely about information and reaction. When you place your stick on the ice, you lock in your biomechanical posture. You reveal the angle of your blade. You reveal your grip.
So you are telegraphing to the opposing center exactly what technique you intend to use.
Exactly. If your blade is angled a certain way, the attacker knows you are going for a backhand pull. If it's angled differently, they know you are planning to sweep forehand or initiate a tie-up.
So by forcing the defending player to commit to their physical posture first, the rulebook is explicitly engineering a massive reaction advantage for the attacking team.
Yes. The attacker gets to analyze the defender's kinetic chain, read their intent, and then perfectly adjust their own grip and stance to counter it before they even put their stick down.
The defense is forced to show their hand, which means if you are a defensive center taking a high leverage draw in your own zone, you have to become an absolute master of physical deception.
You really do. You cannot just put your stick down in your preferred pulling posture. You have to learn to present an ambiguous blade angle or maintain a neutral grip right up until the exact millisecond the puck leaves the official's hand.
So the attacking center cannot get a clean read on your intentions.
Precisely. And this is a perfect example of why you have to know which rule book you are playing under, because these rules are not universal.
Yeah, we have sources covering the regional variations, and they are wildly different. It's like entirely different philosophies of the game.
It is. If you cross the border and play under USA hockey rules, they completely invert the NHL standard.
Really? How so?
In USA hockey, at those 8 non-center spots, the attacking player must place their stick down first.
Which shifts the reaction advantage entirely to the defense.
Hmm.
It's a much more conservative, defense-friendly interpretation of how the game should flow.
Yes. And if you play under Hockey Canada rules, you get a third, completely different standard.
Let me guess. The traditional approach.
Yep. The visiting player always places their stick down first at all 9 spots, regardless of who is attacking or defending. It is a purely traditionalist approach based on home ice advantage.
And then we have the newly released UK in-house rules for the 2026-27 season. How are they handling this?
They've decided to eliminate the sequence entirely.
Just throw it out.
Pretty much. The UK amendment explicitly states that either center can now put their stick down first. It is a complete free-for-all.
Wow.
Yeah, the order carries zero tactical information because it's not mandated. You just set your blade when you are physically ready. However,
yeah.
The UK rules are hyper-strict on the geometry of the stick placement.
Right, the white paint on the dots.
Yes. Under the IIHF standard, a center only needs to have the toe of their stick blade touching the white painted area of the face-off dot. But the UK 2026-27 rule mandates that the entire blade heel to toe must be flat and completely contained within that white portion.
So if you try to gain an angle by just tipping the toe in, you are committing a face-off violation in the UK.
Exactly. Which perfectly transitions us into the most stressful part of this entire event. The minefield of violations.
The minefield. Because if the rules dictate exactly where your stick has to be and exactly what order you have to place it, what happens when a player breaks that sequence? The punishments are severe, and structurally, they are incredibly asymmetrical.
Oh, very asymmetrical. Let's talk about encroachment, the rule that breaks every center's heart.
Okay, set the scene for encroachment.
Encroachment is the perfect example of how a face-off is a 5-man synchronized event. Imagine you are an elite center. You have studied your opponent's tells, you have the perfect stance, you are locked in for a defensive zone draw.
I'm locked in.
But your winger, who is stationed 15 feet away on the outer edge of the circle, gets anxious. A split second before the puck drops, that winger leans forward and their skate blade crosses over the painted hash marks.
The linesperson immediately blows the whistle. The winger cheated. But who actually receives the punishment?
Under NHL rules, and as of the 2026-27 season under IIHF and UK rules, the winger is told to stay exactly where they are.
Home.
It is the center who is immediately ejected from the face-off circle and replaced.
Conceptually, that feels so incredibly unjust.
Yeah.
I mean, the lockpicker goes to jail because the getaway driver flinched.
It feels unjust until you analyze the game theory behind it. It is an information and discipline problem. The encroaching winger is attempting to gain an illegal head start to win the loose puck, right?
Right.
If the referee simply waved the winger back or ejected the winger and made another winger step in, the offending team would still have their elite 60% faceoff specialist taking the draw. There is no real deterrence.
Oh, I see.
By ejecting the center, the rulebook inflicts the maximum possible tactical pain. The team loses their primary draw taker for the most critical moment of the possession. It forces centers to demand absolute discipline from their wingers.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, why does a winger's discipline matter just as much as the center's skill?
Because the winger's mistake removes the center's skill from the equation entirely.
Wow. So if a winger's skate placement is that critical, we need to define the exact boundaries of cheating. Where is the line?
Both states must remain completely outside the face-off circle and outside the hash marks. Now, the nuance here is how different leagues define outside.
Okay, break it down.
Under NHL and IIHF rules, it is perfectly legal for your skate blade to be physically touching the painted line as long as it does not cross completely over it.
But if you try that in Canada.
Exactly. Under Hockey Canada rules, the line belongs to the referee. Merely touching the painted line with your skate counts as encroachment, and your center is gone.
What about the upper body, the stick? Because you constantly see winners leaning aggressively over the hash marks, trying to get their stick blade closer to the dot.
In the NHL and IIHF, the airspace above the circle is essentially free.
Yes.
Your stick is allowed to reach inside the circle and extend past the hash marks, provided you do not physically make contact with an opponent or their stick before the drop.
You can reach, you just cannot step.
Exactly. But again, USA Hockey takes a much more rigid stance.
How rigid?
USA Hockey forbids any penetration of the boundary. The casebook explicitly mandates that both players must be completely behind their respective hash marks, and it specifically notes this includes all sticks and all skates.
So if your carbon fiber crosses the red paint in USA Hockey, your center is ejected.
Gone.
Okay, so the winger twitches, the whistle blows, and your elite center is thrown out of the circle. A replacement player, usually a winger who hasn't practiced face-offs all week, has to skate into the dot.
Yeah, and the psychological pressure on this replacement player is immense because they are stepping into what we call the two-violation trap.
This is where games are lost, right?
Absolutely. When your center gets tossed, that ejection counts as your team's first face-off violation for that specific stoppage. If anyone on your team, the replacement center, a winger, a defenseman, commits a second violation on the ensuing redrop, whether it jumping the gun, encroaching, or illegal stick placement,
the officials blow the whistle again, and it is an immediate 2-minute bench minor penalty for delay of game.
You have just turned a neutral 50-50 puck drop into a penalty kill simply because your 5-man unit lacked physical discipline.
Which dictates exactly how that replacement winger has to play the draw. You cannot risk getting fancy.
The instruction from the bench to a replacement center is universal across the sport. Do not try anything clever. Do not attempt a quick pull. Do not try to anticipate the drop.
So what do they do?
Your only job is to execute a simple heavy tie-up. Jam your stick forward, lock up the opposing center's stick, and rely on your wingers to win the ensuing scramble. You play for a stalemate to ensure you do not jump early and take a penalty.
Now, there is one massive glaring loophole in all this discipline. A scenario where the rules actually encourage you to cheat. The icing exemption.
Ah, yes. This is one of the most fascinating tactical quirks in the sport.
Okay, so when a team ices the puck, meaning they shoot it from behind their own side of the center red line all the way down across the opponent's goal line without it being touched, the ensuing faceoff is governed by a special exemption in the NHL, the current IIHF rulebook, and the UK rules. What is the exemption?
After an icing, the first face-off violation committed by either team does not result in a center ejection. The linesperson will blow the whistle, reset the players, and simply issue a verbal warning.
So the center gets to stay in the dot.
The center gets to stay in the dot.
Think about the game theory of this. If I'm the defending center, my team has just iced the puck because we are exhausted. We are trapped on the ice. We aren't allowed to change lines. I am going up against a fresh offensive center. This rule dictates that I can deliberately try to jump the gun on the face-off timing.
You absolutely should. You are granted one free attempt to cheat the timing of the linesperson's drop. If you time it perfectly, you win the draw and your exhausted team gets to clear the zone.
And if you are a fraction of a second too early.
You commit a violation, but there is no punishment. You just reset.
And the attacking center knows this too. So they know you are going to use your free cheat, which means they are incentivized to use their free cheat to match your aggression.
Exactly.
It turns a standard face-off into a high-speed game of chicken.
It completely changes the physiological rhythm of a post-icing draw. But it is vital to remember this is only applicable in the NHL, the 26-27 IIHF rules, and the UK rules.
Let me guess, USA Hockey.
USA Hockey does not write a post-icing carve-out into their rulebook. If you try to take your free cheat after an icing in a USA Hockey game, you will be immediately ejected from the dot, compounding your exhausted team's problems.
Good to know. So, assuming everyone manages to stand perfectly still and we are legally lined up without triggering a bench minor, we finally reach the moment of impact,
yeah. The
physical battle.
Right, the fun part.
How do we actually win this drop? Let's dive into the anatomy and technique of the lockpicker.
It all begins with the biomechanics of the stance, and specifically the concept of leverage. To move another human being, or to out-leverage them for a piece of rubber, you must lower your center of gravity.
Makes sense.
You need a deep knee bend, a staggered stance where your back foot is loaded with your kinetic energy, and your chest must be positioned directly over the puck.
Now, I want to address a critical misconception here, especially for younger players listening. When a coach screams from the bench to get low, players intuitively interpret that as lowering their field of vision. So they bend at the waist and push their neck and head way out over the face-off dot, practically staring straight down at the ice.
It is a terrible biomechanical habit, and it is incredibly dangerous. Depth and leverage are generated by flexing the hips and bending the knees, not by cervical flexion, you know, bending your neck.
Right.
If your head is pushed out over the dot, your weight is unbalanced forward, making you easy to push off the puck.
And beyond the physics of it, the rule books are actively legislating this out of the game due to CTE and concussion concerns, right?
Yes, very aggressively. In the IIHF Situation Handbook, there is a specific detailed scenario addressing when two centers lean in so aggressively that their heads are almost ear to ear or their helmets are touching before the drop.
And what do the refs do?
Lines persons are strictly instructed to break that alignment up immediately. And under the newly adopted IIHF rules, if a player initiates helmet-to-helmet contact prior to the drop, there is no warning. The lines person will immediately eject the offending center for dangerous play.
Wow. So hips down, head up.
Your hips must be low, but your head must be up and back.
So our center of gravity is dialed in. Let's talk about the upper body, the hands. How is an elite center holding their stick to generate maximum force?
Well, you have your standard hockey grip, which is perfectly fine for basic, quick sweeping motions. But if you watch the elite face-off technicians, the most powerful tool in their arsenal is the reverse grip, which is sometimes referred to as a backhand grip.
Break down the anatomy of the reverse grip for us. What is actually happening with the hands?
You take your bottom hand, the hand situated lower on the shaft, closer to the blade of the stick, and instead of holding it naturally, you roll your wrist entirely over so that your knuckles are facing down toward the ice.
What does that look like?
It is the exact same grip you would use if you were holding a kayak paddle or if you were preparing to deliver a heavy cross-check to an opponent.
It looks incredibly aggressive and physically uncomfortable.
It is unnatural, yeah.
Yeah.
But the biomechanical advantage is massive. By rolling that bottom hand over, you engage the flexor carpal nerus muscle and completely lock your wrist joint.
Oh, I see.
This transforms your forearm and the stick shaft into a single rigid lever. When you pull the puck backward on your backhand side, you are recruiting the large muscles of your back and shoulders to generate massive raw power and speed. And the stick blade will not twist or yield when it hits the opponent's stick.
But there has to be a trade-off. If you lock your kinetic chain into that specific posture, you are limiting your options, aren't you?
Yes. The trade-off is absolute commitment. The moment you roll that hand over into the reverse grip, you completely telegraph your move.
Because they can see your knuckles.
Exactly. The opposing center looks at your knuckles and knows with 100% certainty that you are executing a backhand pull. Furthermore, because your wrist is locked inward, you have almost zero leverage or flexibility if you suddenly need to change tactics and push the puck forward on your forehand.
You're stuck.
If you guess wrong, or if the opponent ties up your backhand sweep, you are structurally trapped.
Okay, so our hips are low, our grip is locked. The final piece of the individual puzzle before the drop is visual processing. Where's the center looking? The intuitive answer is that you stare a hole into the opposing center's stick blade, waiting for them to move.
And that intuitive answer is the ultimate golden rule of what not to do. You must never look at your opponent's stick.
Why? If it's a battle against them, why aren't we watching them?
Because of the limitations of human neural processing, if you wait to see your opponent's stick move, and then your brain registers that movement and then sends the signal to your arms to initiate your own counter movement, you are reacting to their reaction.
Which means you're behind.
You are mathematically guaranteed to be a fraction of a second slower to the puck. Winning a face-off is not a reaction time problem against the opposing player. It is a pure reaction time problem against the physical environment.
So what environmental cue are we looking for?
You look exclusively at the linesperson hand holding the puck, or as the most elite face-off coaches in the world teach, you watch the linesperson's elbow.
The elbow. That is fascinating. Explain the biology of why the elbow is the trigger.
It comes down to human anatomy. A human arm cannot release an object from a static grip without a microscopic prior movement in the proximal joints, in this case the elbow and shoulder, to initiate the downward physical trajectory. Yeah, the elbow physically has to drop a fraction of a second before the neural signal reaches the fingers to open and release the puck. The fingers are the last thing to move.
So you're reading the mechanical chain of the ref's arm.
Exactly. If you train your visual cortex to react to the elbow twitch rather than the fingers opening or the puck dropping, you are literally gaining milliseconds of reaction time. You are moving before the puck is even in free fall.
That is the definition of a microscopic edge. So the elbow twitches, the puck drops. What is the menu of techniques the center is actually trying to execute in that split second?
Well, a complete center needs 3 or 4 distinct rehearsed moves.
Okay, what's first?
First is the backhand pull. This is the bread and butter. A clean, incredibly fast sweep backward to your defenseman, usually utilizing that powerful reverse grip we discussed.
Got it. And second?
Second is the forehand pull. This is biomechanically weaker for most players, but it is absolutely necessary depending on which side of the ice the faceoff is on and where your defensemen are stationed.
Makes sense. Third?
Third is the tie-up. In this technique, you do not try to win the puck at all. Your sole objective is to jam your stick blade forcefully over or under your opponent's stick to neutralize their movement.
Effectively turning a one-on-one skill battle into a loose puck scramble for your wingers to resolve.
Exactly. And fourth is the stick lift. This is a highly aggressive, high-risk maneuver. You violently lift their stick blade completely off the ice before playing the puck yourself.
High risk, high reward.
Yes, the reward is a perfectly clean win. The risk is that if you miss their stick, you have essentially lifted your own stick out of the play and left the puck completely undefended for them to take.
Now, I hear older players talk about a fifth option, going through the man.
Ooh.
Just ignoring the puck and blasting the opposing center physically.
You can execute a physical play, but timing is the absolute differentiator between a brilliant tactical move and a penalty. You cannot initiate body contact before the puck hits the ice.
That's interference, right?
Mm. That is an interference penalty. It's discretionary in the NHL, but it is a mandatory call in USA Hockey. You must wait until the puck physically touches the painted dot, and then you can lean your body weight heavily into the opponent, physically taking their ice and the puck simultaneously.
What about improvising with other parts of the body? Like if my stick gets tied up, can I just drop my stick and snatch the puck out of the air with my glove before it hits the ice?
Absolutely not. Batting or grabbing the puck out of the air on a face-off by the two competing centers is explicitly illegal across all rule books. It results in an immediate minor penalty for delay of game.
So no hands?
No hands. The centers are legally prohibited from playing the puck with their hand until a third player, a winger or defenseman, has touched it first.
What about using your feet?
This is where we see a massive regional schism. In the NHL, kicking the puck backward with your skate blade to win a faceoff is not only perfectly legal, it is considered a brilliant, high-level technique when your stick is tied up.
I see that all the time on TV.
Right. But if you attempt that exact same maneuver in an IIHF or UK-sanctioned game, winning the draw with your skates is a specific violation that will result in your immediate ejection from the circle.
Wow. But obviously, in all leagues, kicking the opposing player is strictly prohibited.
Oh, universally. Kicking an opponent is a match penalty. Everywhere. Always. And USA Hockey takes it a step further. Their rulebook doesn't even require a distinct kicking motion.
What do you mean?
If you simply use your skate blade to push off an opponent's foot for leverage, you are receiving a major penalty and a game misconduct. Keep your skates focused on the puck, never the person.
Okay, before we zoom out to the team tactics, let's talk about the bench. If I am a center sitting on the bench waiting for my shift, I shouldn't just be resting. I should be scouting.
Mm.
What specific tells am I looking for in the opposing center?
Every player has a physical tell, a default posture they revert to under pressure. You should be analyzing the opposing centers every single time they take a draw, regardless of whether you are on the ice.
So what am I watching?
Look at their grip. Do they roll that bottom hand over into the reverse grip for every defensive zone draw? Look at their feet. Which foot is heavily loaded with their weight? That biomechanical load tells you exactly which way their hips are preparing to rotate.
You can also read their psychological intent based on their muscle tension, right?
Absolutely. If a center steps into the dot with a white-knuckled grip, coiled incredibly low, vibrating with kinetic energy, they are telegraphing that they're trying to beat you clean with speed.
And if they don't?
Conversely, if they step in standing a little more upright with a relaxed grip on the stick, they are mathematically eliminating their ability to win a speed battle. That tells you they aren't going for the puck at all. They are planning to execute a tie-up, neutralize your stick, and rely on their wingers.
This is a perfect place to synthesize the individual physical battle. So let's do a quick review.
Good idea.
If you are a center stepping into the dot, your mental checklist is this. Drop your center of gravity using your hips and knees, keeping your head back. Decide if you are committing to the reverse grip for raw power. Do not look at the opponent's stick. Lock your visual focus onto the official's elbow and react to the drop with a specific rehearsed technique based on the blade angle the defending center was forced to show you.
Which brings us to the moment exactly 1 millisecond after the puck hits the ice. Because winning that physical battle is only step one.
Right. This transitions us from the micro to the macro. The individual skill morphs instantly into a five-player chess match.
It really does.
A face-off is not a one-on-one battle. It is a five-on-five set play. The other four players on the ice, the wingers and the defensemen, have exactly choreographed routes they must run the second the puck is dropped. And those geometric routes change entirely depending on what zone the face-off is located in. Let's start with the defensive zone. You are backed up deep in your own end, 20 feet from your goaltender. The stakes are at their absolute highest.
The spatial setup here is highly conservative and defensively oriented. Your inside winger, the winger closest to the center of the rink, stands on the inside hash mark facing the slot, which is the most dangerous real estate on the ice.
Okay.
Your board side winger is positioned on the outside hash mark near the wall. You have one defenseman stationed deep in the slot directly in front of your goalie to clear rebounds, and your other defenseman is positioned behind the faceoff dot closer to the wall, acting as a safety valve.
Given that geometry, what is the absolute golden rule for the center taking a defensive zone draw?
Never, under any circumstances, lose the puck cleanly to the middle of the ice.
Never to the middle.
Never. A clean loss that goes directly to the opponent's strong side point man in the center of the blue line is a catastrophic failure. A tie-up is completely acceptable. Losing it to the boards is acceptable. But losing it cleanly to the middle is how you end up on a highlight reel for all the wrong reasons.
So the center's job is to protect the middle. Now let's walk through the tactical branches for the wingers based on the outcome of the drop. Branch 1. The center fails and loses the draw cleanly to the opposing defenseman at the blue line. What is the immediate responsibility of the wingers?
Both wingers must instantaneously release from the hash marks and sprint in a straight line directly to the opposing pointman.
So they don't look for the puck.
They do not pause to locate the puck. They do not wait to see if their center might recover it. They launch off the hash marks in the millisecond the elbow twitches to establish their bodies in the shooting lanes and block the incoming shot.
That is the loss branch. Now let's talk about branch 2, the tie-up. The two centers clash, their sticks get jammed together, and the puck is just sitting there dead in the white paint.
This specific scenario is arguably the most undercoached, misunderstood moment in all of hockey. When a draw is tied up, it creates a free 50-50 puck sitting in a 2-foot geographical area surrounded by 8 intensely focused players.
And human psychology takes over. What usually happens?
The bystander effect.
Everyone just watches.
Players freeze. The wingers stand on the hash marks and watch the two centers struggle, waiting to see who is going to win the physical battle and pop the puck loose. That hesitation is a fatal tactical mistake.
Why?
On a tied-up draw, the puck belongs to whoever decides to take it. The inside winger and the board side defenseman must crash the dot instantly with violence. Do not wait for the puck to come to you. You attack the loose puck in the pile. Whoever initiates movement first will win that possession.
Okay, let's flip the ice completely. We are now in the offensive zone. We are attacking.
The geometry completely inverts. Because you are on the attack, both of your defensemen are positioned high up at the blue line, rather than one being deep.
Why are they both high?
Because if you lose an offensive zone draw cleanly, your priority instantly flips from offense to preventing a rapid counterattack. One defenseman stays on the strong side to receive the puck and shoot if you win, but the weak side defenseman must hold the far blue line as a safety valve to prevent a breakaway.
And this offensive lineman is where we get to see teams run incredibly intricate set plays. The D one-timer is the classic. Break down the mechanics of how that works.
It requires perfect synchronization. The center's job is to pull the puck straight back with maximum velocity to the strong side defenseman stationed at the blue line. But the critical element is that this defenseman does not wait to receive the puck in a neutral stance.
What are they doing?
They already have their feet planted, their hips open, and their stick pulled back into a shooting posture before the puck is even dropped by the official.
It's exactly like a football quarterback operating out of the shotgun who catches the snap while already standing in a throwing stance. You completely bypass the mechanical time it takes to receive the pass, settle the puck, look at the net, and step into the shot. The puck arrives on the glade and is instantaneously blasted toward the net.
Beautiful analogy, yes. But for that puck to reach the net, it requires the inside winger to do something highly counterintuitive.
Right. The inside winger must intentionally step backward out of the play to clear the physical shooting lane. If they crash the net too early, they end up blocking their own defenseman's shot.
Exactly.
But defensive systems adapt. What if the opposing team has pre-scouted this, they know the D1 timer is coming, and their defensive winger aggressively sprints at our shooting defenseman the second the puck drops?
If the opponent is cheating toward the point, you counter with the winger walkout.
How does that work?
The center recognizes the aggressive posture of the opponent's winger. Instead of pulling the puck all the way back to the blue line, the center executes a short sideways pull directly to their own inside winger.
Oh, because that space is open now.
Exactly. Because the opposing defending winger just sprinted away to cover the blue line, they have completely vacated the middle of the ice. Your inside winger catches the short pass, walks directly into that empty high danger space, and has a point blank shot on goal.
It is literal physical chess. You are manipulating the opponent's defensive routes to create negative space. What about the neutral zone? What is a tactical mindset when the faceoff is located between the blue lines?
The neutral zone is essentially the laboratory of the NHL because losing a faceoff at center ice carries very little immediate structural risk, provided your defensemen are positioned correctly behind the play. This is the zone where elite centers experiment.
What kind of experiments are we talking about? Testing new grips?
Testing grips, testing the opponent's reaction time, or executing high-risk plays like the lose-it-forward technique.
What is that?
In this play, instead of pulling the puck back to your defense, you intentionally push the puck forward, past the opposing center's skates, and then attempt to physically skate around them to retrieve it yourself, instantly generating forward momentum.
I want to clarify a massive rulebook distinction on that lose-it-forward play. You have to skate around the opposing center.
Good point.
Because if you push the puck forward and then attempt to skate directly through the center, especially in women's hockey or leagues with strict interference standards, that is an immediate penalty for an illegal hit or interference.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot legally run over a stationary player just because you push the puck past them.
That is a vital clarification. You are attacking the space, not the player. But tactically, neutral zone wins present a unique statistical dilemma. The analytics show that a one neutral zone draw very often just results in the winning team immediately dumping the puck deep into the offensive zone to initiate a forecheck.
And statistically, a dump-in is a very low-yield offensive strategy, right?
Exactly. A possession sequence that begins with a clean neutral zone faceoff win but ends in a dump-in produces significantly fewer expected goals than a possession that ends in a controlled, possession-based carry over the offensive blue line.
So it's basically wasted effort.
Winning the draw in the neutral zone is meaningless if your team's tactical system just voluntarily surrenders possession by dumping it in 3 seconds later. If you win it, you must have an active, coordinated plan to carry it across the blue line with control.
Let's do a quick structural recap of this five-player geometry. If your team is facing a defensive zone tie-up, the absolute fatal mistake a winger can make is freezing on the hash marks to watch the battle.
Yes, exactly.
A tied-up puck has no owner. The winger must instantly crash the dot and aggressively attack the loose puck.
Movement equals possession.
We're in the home stretch now. We have covered the physics, the rules, the individual techniques, and the five-man systems. Now we put it all together in the crucible. We're going to examine the high-leverage situations.
The moments that matter.
These are the 10 to 15 draws a game that fundamentally alter the win probability. First up, the post-icing draw.
We discussed the free cheat violation you get here, but the positional and physiological advantages are even more overwhelming.
Right, because of the line change rule.
When a team ices the puck, they are legally prohibited from changing their players. Those five skaters are exhausted, their lactic acid is spiking, and they cannot leave the ice. Furthermore, the coach is prohibited from using a timeout to rest them.
They're completely trapped in their own zone.
Yes. Meanwhile, the attacking team, the team that forced the icing, gets to calmly deploy a completely fresh line of their absolute best offensive players. And under NHL and IIHF rules, the attacking team is granted the privilege of choosing exactly which of the two end zone dots the faceoff will occur on.
So they don't just get fresh legs. They get to dictate the geometry. They pick the dot that perfectly favors their elite center's strong hand, setting up their preferred offensive zone set play against five players who can barely breathe. It is an overwhelming, mathematically engineered advantage.
It is. Unless, again, you are playing USA hockey, where there is no choice of dot and the line change freezing rules have different nuances. But in professional hockey, forcing an icing and executing on the ensuing draw is the most reliably exploitable offensive situation in the sport.
Which brings us to the ultimate pressure cooker. The scenario that defines seasons. The goalie pulled, 6-on-5. Set the scene for us. There are 45 seconds left in the game. You are down by one goal, you have an offensive zone face-off, and you pull your goalie for an extra attacker.
The tension is absolute. You have one empty net sitting 150 feet behind you. The structural alignment completely morphs to maximize offensive pressure. You have your extra attacker, who usually drives straight to the net front to obscure the opposing goalie's vision and create physical chaos.
Where are the defensemen?
Both of your defensemen are stationed high at the points to keep the puck in the zone.
And the center.
The psychological burden on the center in a 6-on-5 draw is unimaginable. You must win this draw cleanly backward to your point men.
Why is it so critical?
Because if you make a mistake, if you use the wrong grip, if you react a millisecond too late and lose the draw cleanly forward, the puck goes straight to the opposing defensive specialists. And because both of your defensemen are pinched high, those opposing players have a completely clear, uncontested lane to fire the puck 150 feet down the ice into your empty net, instantly ending the game.
It is the single highest leverage, highest risk draw in the sport. It is binary survival.
Without question. The game state hinges entirely on those 3 seconds. And astoundingly, despite the massive statistical weight of this specific scenario, it is rarely practiced with sufficient frequency by teams at the amateur level. They practice the 6-on-5 system, but they don't isolate and drill the immense pressure of that specific initiating faceoff.
Okay, we have excavated a massive amount of technical terrain today. We need to synthesize this masterclass into a cohesive mental model.
If you are going to retain one overarching framework from this discussion, it is this. A face-off is not merely a physical scramble or a test of brute strength.
What is that?
It is a high-speed, multi-layered information game. You are simultaneously processing the legal boundaries of the hash marks, the regional variations of the rulebook, and the biomechanical tells of your opponent's stance.
So much processing.
It is. You combine that immense data processing with a highly specific, closed-scale physical reaction training your eyes to watch the official's elbow, not the puck. And then you multiply all of that by the precise, synchronized execution of a 5-player unit running a zone-specific tactical route.
Let's distill this down into our final permanent takeaways. If you are a player, a coach, or a fan trying to master this topic, these are the fundamental principles you need to embed in your long-term memory. Let's do the top 10.
First, abandon the myth of overall team percentages. Do not evaluate a player based on a 52% aggregate. Evaluate them on how they prepare for and execute the 10 to 15 high-leverage draws that actually dictate the game state, like the penalty kill or the 6-on-5.
Second, understand the map and the cause and effect of stoppages. An elite player knows exactly where the next draw is going based on whether a pass was offside or if the goalie steered a rebound, and they skate to that dot to establish physical position early.
Third, memorize the sequence of stick placement. In the NHL and IIHF, the defending center is forced to put their stick down first, which reveals their biomechanical intent and gifts the attacking center a massive reaction advantage.
Fourth, respect the geography of cheating. Encroachment by a winger over the painted hash marks results in the center being ejected from the draw. The winger's lack of discipline punishes the team's best asset.
Fifth, understand situational rule exemptions. After an icing, you are granted one free cheating violation warning. Elite centers use that warning to aggressively anticipate the drop without fear of a penalty.
Sixth, master the anatomy of leverage. Get low by flexing your knees and dropping your hips. Never put your head forward over the dot, or you compromise your balance and risk an immediate ejection for helmet-to-helmet contact under the new international rules.
Seventh, retrain your visual cortex. Never watch your opponent's stick blade. Watch the linesperson's elbow, because human biology dictates that the proximal joint must move before the distal fingers can release the puck.
Eighth, dictate the defensive zone geometry. If you are taking a draw deep in your own end, your absolute prime directive is to never lose the puck cleanly to the middle of the ice. A tie-up is a victory compared to a clean loss to the slot.
Ninth, cure the bystander effect. On a tied-up draw, the puck has no owner. Do not wait to see who wins the wrestling match. The first player to decisively move their feet and crash the dot wins the loose puck.
And finally, tenth, communication is paramount. Teach your wingers the intricate rules of the hash marks and the stick placement. A 30-second conversation on the bench clarifying the boundaries saves your elite center from getting tossed out of a game-deciding draw.
That is the complete integrated framework. If you understand those principles, you understand the foundational architecture of possession in modern hockey.
That is an unbelievable synthesis. Thank you for walking us through the physics, the history, and the psychology of this. But before we sign off, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocative thought. Next time you sit down to watch a game, or next time you are standing behind the glass at your local rink, I challenge you to completely ignore the lock picker.
Oh, I like this.
When the whistle blows, do not watch the center. Do not watch the puck drop.
Watch the winger's skates hovering over the hash mark.
Exactly. Watch who blinks first. Watch the defensemen at the blue line physically cock their sticks into a shooting posture before the puck even hits the ice. Watch the goaltender subtly slide to the right to force the whistle on their center strong side.
It's a whole different game.
You are now seeing a meticulously choreographed heist, a high-stakes game of physical chess that 99% of fans are completely blind to. The vault is opening, and you now know exactly what every single person in the room is supposed to do.
Once you see the underlying structure, you will never look at a simple puck drop the same way again.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. Our goal today was to give you a masterclass in this specific closed skill. Take these concepts, share them with your line mates, integrate them into your coaching systems, or just use them to see the matrix the next time you are watching a broadcast.
Remember, tactical knowledge is only truly powerful when you synthesize it and apply it on the ice.
Until next time, keep your sticks on the ice and stay curious.